From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Carol Bousquet with the news on this day in Maine, June 6th. The number of Mainers hospitalized with COVID has been falling again after a brief bump last week. It's down to 160 today. That's 33 fewer than last Thursday, when 193 people were hospitalized. And it's down 71 from mid-May, when cases recently peaked. The Portland City Council tonight will vote to request that the state establish a homelessness management task force. Portland Mayor Kate Snyder says the city needs help with the rising number of people in need of housing and would like to see changes to general assistance laws and the creation of a statewide shelter system.
The state did respond in some ways to the issues that we're facing, but we certainly don't want to go into FY24 with the same kinds of challenges. And I think that we have an opportunity here to, you know, convene people to come together to talk about the issues we face and some possible solutions before the legislature convenes in January.
Snyder says Portland is facing a major housing burden and can no longer provide all of the assistance that is needed to address the issue. She says lawmakers did provide $10 million in the state's most recent budget to be distributed to towns and cities for general assistance. The U.S. Air Force says it will investigate PFAS chemicals at the former Loring Air Force Base after finding sites contaminated with the so-called forever chemicals. The firefighting foam used for aircraft training exercises on the main runway contains PFAS and may have spread to other areas. Carl Flora, president and CEO of Loring Commerce Center, says preliminary results indicate drinking water supplies are not impacted.
We feel very fortunate because not everybody has had this luxury, but where it's been deposited at Loring, there are no drinking water wells anywhere nearby, so it doesn't appear to have affected any drinking water.
Flora says he expects the U.S. Air Force to be testing sites in and around the former base throughout the summer, and the military will handle any remediation that is needed. Attorneys for the state have failed to block a lawsuit that alleges Maine is not providing adequate legal representation to low-income defendants. Kevin Miller reports.
In March, the ACLU of Maine filed a class action lawsuit claiming that the state is violating the constitutional rights of defendants who cannot afford their own lawyers. The Maine Attorney General's office had asked the court to dismiss the lawsuit, but on Monday, Superior Court Judge Michaela Murphy ruled that the ACLU had demonstrated enough potential harm to allow the lawsuit to continue. Murphy did, however, dismiss part of the lawsuit that dealt with rules governing the legal defense system. Maine is the only state that does not have a public defender's office. Instead, the Maine Commission on Indigent Legal Services contracts with private attorneys to represent low-income clients. But the commission has been struggling to find enough lawyers willing to do the work, and one commissioner recently warned that the system had, quote, gone over a cliff by failing to quickly connect defendants with lawyers. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Kevin Miller.
President Joe Biden was duly elected in 2020, and his victory was not influenced by rampant voter fraud or misconduct by election officials. But the two Maine Republicans vying to challenge Democratic 2nd District Congressman Jared Golden and Independent Tiffany Bond are refusing to acknowledge those facts. Steve Missler has more.
Biden's victory over former President Donald Trump was certified by Republican and Democratic election officials. In some cases, exhaustive recounts and audits were conducted to verify the results, and did. And Trump's own Department of Justice ruled out the idea that widespread fraud had any effect on the outcome. But when congressional candidate Liz Caruso addressed the Maine Republican State Convention in late April, she made a promise.
Not only do we need secure borders, but the American Republic must have confidence in secure elections. In Congress, I'll fight for the truth on the 2020 election.
Caruso is challenging former Congressman Bruce Poliquin for the right to challenge Democratic Congressman Jared Golden and Independent Tiffany Bond in November in a primary election that will be decided next Tuesday. When asked during a recent interview with Maine Public what she believes is the truth about the 2020 election, Caruso said that a lot of people have doubts about the outcome, and that she's one of them.
I mean, do you believe that President Joe Biden was duly elected, fairly, without widespread fraud?
Well, I mean, the Electoral College, I mean, officially certified him. But until we find out that there really wasn't fraud, until we let the organizations go through the steps of confirming it, then we can't say for sure.
Exactly what organizations Caruso was referring to isn't clear. But she isn't the only one reluctant to recognize Biden's victory.
Let's look back at the 2020 election. Who won the presidential race?
Well, here in the state of Maine, President Trump was the certified winner in the 2nd District twice in 2016 and also in 2020.
That's former Congressman Bruce Poliquin during a recent interview with New Center Maine's Rob Caldwell. Poliquin, as he did when confronted with this question earlier this spring, never directly responded, despite Caldwell's pressing.
To make sure they secure...
This is a convoluted answer to a straightforward, clear-cut question. Mm-hmm. Who won the presidential election in 2020?
Here in the state of Maine?
That's not what I asked. In the United States of America, who won?
Poliquin attempted to pivot to inflation and his disagreements with Biden before repeating his previous answer.
All I can tell you is that he was the certified winner in our 2nd District. That's great, but I'm focusing on my campaign. I don't look back, I look forward.
In other words, Poliquin is confident Trump won the 2nd District, but he won't say Biden won Maine or the 2020 election overall. These sort of responses are commonplace among Republican politicians, especially those running for office this year. And there's a reason why an election decided nearly 2 years ago is a topic of discussion now. The man who lost the 2020 election, Trump, still insists that he won, and he's vowed to punish Republicans who contradict him, just as he attempted to do in Georgia.
But I'm going to be here in a year and a half, and I'm going to be campaigning against your governor and your crazy Secretary of State. That I can tell you.
Trump-backed primary challengers to defeat Georgia Governor Brian Kemp and Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, two Republicans who resisted the former president's call not to certify election results in a state Biden won. Trump's efforts this year to defeat Kemp and Raffensperger failed, but he's been successful in other contests, and he remains an influential force among Republican voters, 60% of whom believe his falsehoods about the 2020 election, according to a poll taken in December. Caruso, the candidate challenging Poliquin for the GOP nomination in Maine's 2nd District, was recently asked if the former president is responsible for undermining confidence in the 2020 election.
No. I think voters can make their own determination. I don't think they're just listening to one person.
But it's not one person making this assertion anymore. The so-called Stop the Steal movement that Trump and his allies built has moved from the fringe to the mainstream of Republican politics, aided by conservative media, elected officials, and candidates. Some of those candidates believe the former president. Others go along with it, hoping to gain or retain the backing of Trump supporters. It's unclear which of those two categories Poliquin and Caruso fall into, but one of them will be on the ballot in November. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
The University of Maine system has been embroiled in controversy in recent weeks with layoffs and a mishandled presidential search, leading to staff across the system issuing votes of no confidence against the system chancellor. But it's a situation years in the making, as staff say leaders have repeatedly failed to listen to their concerns and have fought against efforts to add more faculty voices to the system's board of trustees. Robbie Feinberg has more.
Lisa LeDuc, a professor at the University of Maine at Presque Isle, became a faculty representative to the board 6 years ago. Even then, she remembers just how difficult it was to get her voice heard. She recalls a retreat when then-Chancellor James Page was upset that several faculty groups had sent a letter to the board airing their concerns.
And he said, this information should be coming through you. And I said, and where are we supposed to do that?
LeDuc says for years, faculty communication with trustees has only been listed as a discussion item in just one board subcommittee. And even there, LeDuc says, the board has cut off some faculty comments or simply moved on with little discussion. It's a situation that staff say has only gotten worse in recent years, as they feel their concerns have largely been ignored on major university issues. That lack of trust and communication has reared its head in recent weeks, as faculty groups on several campuses have issued no confidence votes in Chancellor Daniel Malloy. Some staff have called for his resignation. The turmoil comes in the wake of layoffs and a mismanaged presidential search process at the University of Maine at Augusta that could cost the system more than $600,000 in future years.
I think no confidence votes are really a last resort.
USM geography professor Lydia Savage says much of the current frustration stems back to the system's push for unified accreditation at all seven of the state's university campuses several years ago. Trustees argued the unification would allow campuses to more easily share resources and increase access to coursework. But Savage says concerns over the plan have only grown as the system's central office has taken on even more authority, such as overseeing new hires on each of the campuses and pushing for a new statewide engineering school, despite questions from faculty at the University of Southern Maine.
I think that kind of central control, it's much easier to feel distrustful about that.
Some faculty say they reached a breaking point in late 2020 when officials proposed transitioning about 3,000 retirees away from their current group health insurance plan, instead offering them a stipend on a private exchange. Jim McClymer, a professor and president of the faculty union, says retirees panicked that the new plan would result in major cost increases that they couldn't handle on a fixed income.
And it took a really long time, lots of actions and a lawsuit to get them to reverse course. At any point, the university could have come to us and said, we want to talk to you about some alternatives working with health insurance, and we could have worked on this as a partnership. I think they revealed there was no partnership.
In recent years, lawmakers have passed two bills designed to boost staff input by adding faculty and staff to the system's Board of Trustees, though the latest bill introduced earlier this year wouldn't have allowed the staff members to vote. Both were ultimately vetoed by Governor Janet Mills. A spokesperson for the governor didn't respond to a request for comment, but in her veto letter, Mills argued the measure would go against state and university policies and called it, quote, bad public policy to authorize active employees to serve on a board that sets their salaries, governs their budget, and otherwise makes decisions that directly impact them. Democratic State Representative Rebecca Millette, who sponsored the bills, says they wouldn't have been able to fix system leaders' recent mistakes. But she says staff could have more of an opportunity to work with trustees on issues, instead of feeling forced to resort to a measure like a no-confidence vote.
If we had been able to pass that legislation, that perhaps the response would have been more muted at the minimum. That there would have been chances for these concerns to have been addressed in the right forum rather than having to be so public, and maybe even have avoided it.
Despite those legislative defeats, system leaders appear to be trying to mend the frayed relationship. The system's new board chair, Trish Riley, says after her election last month, she began reaching out to faculty to find ways to improve communication and work together.
I think reevaluate how that works and how to make it work more effectively. And I think, again, I want to do that with them and figure out what works best for both the trustees and the faculty.
Chancellor Malloy also acknowledged that while he's held several town halls and listening sessions in recent years, more communication is needed from his office, too. Some faculty members say they're encouraged at the board's recent steps, but James Cook, a sociology professor at the University of Maine at Augusta, says fundamental changes are needed, too, including reassessing the system's current direction and consolidation of authority.
I hope the board and the chancellor will take this opportunity to really radically review the assumptions that they've made about what Maine needs in order to move forward.
Both faculty and system leaders agree that mending their relationship will be important moving forward, particularly as the system faces potential enrollment and financial challenges in the years ahead. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
Governor Janet Mills announced 20 new conservation projects today under the state's Land for Maine's Future program. The governor's office says a third of the applications came from municipalities. Windham Town Planning Director Amanda Lassard says the East Windham Conservation Project is a 660-acre parcel identified by residents as an important area to conserve amidst increasing development pressure.
both because it's a very large, unfragmented habitat block, and it meets our goals of protecting water quality in the area.
Lessard says Land for Maine's future funds will match a $1.8 million town bond to purchase the parcel from two private landowners. Town residents will vote on the bond June 18th. Other projects selected this year span from Kittery to Machias. The Land for Maine's Future program was established under a state bond in 1987 as the state's primary method of conserving land. More than 600,000 acres have been protected. Congresswoman Shelley Pingree and USDA Undersecretary Jenny Lester Moffitt met with Maine farmers in Brunswick today to talk about $2 billion in new USDA funding for farmers, ways to streamline the paperwork associated with federal funds, and the effects of climate change on Maine agriculture. Crystal Spring Community Farm Manager Seth Craig says in his 20 years on the farm, the growing season has expanded by almost a month. Dry stretches are far more frequent, and the rain that does fall tends to come in heavier events that are hard on the crops and the soil.
Weather has always been a huge variable in agriculture, but it's getting much more volatile and much more difficult to deal with.
Pingree says some of the new funds from the USDA announced June 1st will support organic farming practices that can mitigate the climate impacts on agriculture and help farmers adapt. Supporters say the program, known as the Food System Transformation Framework, will also aim to make food supply chains more resilient, reduce the dominance of huge agribusiness corporations, and emphasize equity by better serving impoverished communities. Acadia National Park is keeping tabs on how skyrocketing gas prices might impact visitation this summer, but early signs point to another busy season. Nicole Grisco reports.
Members of the Acadia National Park Advisory Commission say they're concerned that with high gas prices, park entrance fees, and the cost of making a reservation to visit Cadillac Mountain, a visit to the park may be financially out of reach for the average Maine family. Park Superintendent Kevin Snyder says reservations are necessary to control the traffic at popular spots.
In the context of a person's lodging, the reservation fee is relatively small. But, you know, visiting here with the price of gas, with the price of a hotel room, you know, your meals, everything else, it is, unfortunately, you know, it is a real cost for people.
Visitation to the park in April was down 4.5% as compared to last year. But last year, a record was set for April, and Snyder says this Memorial Day was as busy as ever. He says lines waiting to pass through the Sand Beach entrance station ranged from 25 to 45 minutes that weekend. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Nicole Grisco.
And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org and join us tomorrow morning for Maine Calling at 11. I'm Carol Bousquet.